This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Mellencamp has been performing and writing songs for 3.5 decades. His hits in the 80s include Jack and Diane and Small Town. His song, This Is Our Country, first became famous when it was used in a Chevrolet ad. And at the Obama inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, Mellencamp sang his song Pink Houses, the one with the refrain, Ain't That America for You and Me. Mellencamp's new CD, No Better Than This, revisits an earlier era. Not by re-recording old songs, but by recording new ones in places where some of the great artists recorded their records, and using vintage equipment like an old Ampex reel-to-reel tape recorder and just one microphone. That's what Mellencamp was doing last year on his days off while touring with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. The result, with no overdubs, is a sound that's vibrant and vital from the opening notes, as with this song, Right Behind Me.
This town I'm leaving, I ain't a kid. Walking out the door forevermore. You see the devil, he's right behind me, whistling in my ear. It's time to go. You know the devil, he thinks he got me. He ain't got me. No.
Terry spoke with John Mellencamp last year when his album called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom was released. Here's the opening track from that album, a song called Longest Days.
Seems like once upon a time ago, I was where I was supposed to be. My vision was true and my heart was too. There was no end to what I could dream. Walk like a hero into the setting sun. Everyone called out my name. Death to me was just a mystery. I was too busy raising a cane. But nothing lasts forever. The best efforts don't always pay. Sometimes you get sick and you don't get better. That's when life is short, even in its longest days.
John Mellencamp, welcome to Fresh Air. I have to say, you know, I just wasn't prepared for this song that opens the new CD. It's just so much about mortality and things that aren't necessarily ever going to get better. When I first started listening to the song, I think I was kind of depressed. It was the middle of winter. And it really spoke to me. Sometimes you really need songs like this. So thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. The song actually was that line. My grandmother lived to be 100 years old. And it's a funny, it's not a funny ha-ha story, but this is how the line came about. I used to go see her in the afternoons, and sometimes she'd make me lay in bed with her. You know, I was like 45 years old or something. And my 100-year-old grandmother, but she called me Buddy, and she'd go, Buddy, come and lay down with me. And I'd go, okay. So I'd lay in bed with her, and we'd talk sometimes. And you know, she was great up until about 99, and then she started getting kind of dementia and stuff like that. And one afternoon, I was laying in bed with her, and she said, let's pray. And I said, okay. And so she starts praying, and she says, God, you know, Buddy and I are ready to come home. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. Grandma, you're ready to come home. Buddy's only 45. He's not ready. And then she turned at me and looked at me right in the face, and her face all of a sudden looked like a little girl. And she goes, Buddy, life is short in its longest days. And I always remembered that line, and I thought, well, surely someday I'll be able to work that line into a song. And that's how that song started.
You know, it's funny that, you know, your grandmother would have said life is short in its longest days, because one of the things I like so much about the song is that hook, and it's so, although this isn't a country song per se, there's so many country songs that have that kind of contradictory language in its title, like Roger Miller has a song called More and More I Miss You Less and Less, you know, that that kind of like contradiction, and so you just got that from her.
Well, you know, I don't really see it as a contradiction itself. I just think it's a true statement. I mean,
yeah.
I look at my kids and I look at myself and I go, wow, what happened? You know, where did this all go? And of course, my parents were very explicit with me about, you know, John, time goes by real quick, and you know, you better try to enjoy every moment. My dad has been retired from his job since he was 49 years old, and he's 79 now. And every day he says the same thing to me. He says, "Did you do anything fun for yourself today?" And I'll go, "No, Dad, I'm working." He goes, "You got to do something for yourself fun every day, because if you don't, then life's going to pass you by, and you just, you know, what good is it?"
No, I mean, you're obviously feeling that song that we just heard, Longest Days, but it's also great song craft. Can you talk a little bit about your process of writing a song like this? You were telling us that the main hook, the Life is Short line, basically came from your grandmother, but what about the rest of it?
Well, you know, as I've matured as a songwriter, I realize that if it's out there, it's mine. You know, everything I see and hear, I don't care if Shakespeare wrote it, or if Tennessee Williams wrote it, or if Bob Dylan wrote it, or I see it on a sitcom. If I hear words, they're mine. And then what happens is that I'll sit down, and if I have to labor over the song, generally the song is not very good. My best songs are just given to me from someplace outside myself. It's like the Longest Days. I got up one morning and the song came to me in a complete thought. Hmm. All I had to do was get up and write it down. There was no laboring about rhymes or melody or any of that stuff. It just was, there it is. And when that happens, you know, you just kind of got to look up and go, thank you.
John, you're in your studio and you have your guitar with you. So I'm going to ask you if you could sing another song pertaining to mortality. And this is called A Ride Back Home.
Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? I've been out here in this world too long on my own. I won't bother you no more if you can just get me in the door. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? When I started out, I was so young and so strong. I just let it roll off my back when things went wrong. Now it's starting to get to me, all of this inhumanity. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home?
Thank you. And that's John Mellencamp performing a song from his CD, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. Do you mind if I ask what kind of religion you were brought up with, like what church was like when you were young?
Well, my grandmother, back to my grandmother, made sure that I went to church every Sunday. And she'd come over and pick us boys up, and we would go to the Nazarene Church. And back then, that was about as close to heaven as I ever got, because just the time to be able to spend with her, and she was very, very religious. But see, you know, I'm in. I don't even worry about it, because before she died, she said, "Listen, buddy, when you die, I'll be waiting on you, and you're in." So I figure, you know, I got nothing to do. She's taking care of it for me. So if there is a heaven, I'm in. So I don't even think about it. Although she did say, "Buddy, you're going to have to stop that cussing." But other than that, you know, if I can just clean up my language, I'm pretty sure I'm in the Golden Gates. So I trust her and I believe her. And so Yeah, I grew up Nazarene. That's where I went to church. And then finally, about 17 or 18, I just kind of quit going.
Here's another mortality question, if you don't mind. You know, as I've been saying, there's a bunch of songs on the new CD that are about mortality. You had heart surgery in the 1990s, right?
I had a mild heart attack because I smoke and because I have high cholesterol. And for 10 years before that, the doctors were telling me, John, you need to get on cholesterol medicine. My answer was always the same. Am I all right now? And they go, yeah, you're all right now, but you're heading for disaster. Okay, well, I'll deal with disaster when it gets here. Well, it got here. So I have no one to blame or anything like that about having a heart malfunction. But I did not have open heart surgery or anything like that.
So this was more than 10 years ago. And
actually, it was 1994.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't writing songs like this then, were you?
Yes, I was. I've been writing. See, the problem is that music is so, during the 80s and the 70s, and, you know, the songs and the arrangements of the songs had to be a certain way to get on the radio, and it really screwed up songs. It really messed up. I've been writing about this stuff forever. I've been writing about mortality. I've been writing about... You know, I only write four songs. Come on, I got the same four songs. I just rewrite them, 50 times. But I got four topics that I cover. You know, I cover race, and I cover what you're calling mortality. And then I, sometimes write about girls, but I'm too old to write about that now. So, I only got a few things I write about. But if you listen to songs that I've written, some people ain't no damn good. They, that song is about mortality. When the walls come crumbling down, it was about the government. So because of the music and the lightness and the arrangements of the music of that time were of a certain ilk and even got worse in the 90s, the songs, to be able to be on the radio, really had to take on a candy-coated appeal. Pink Houses was always anti-Reaganomics. People loved the Ain't That America. So, people take from songs only what they want to hear. And I'm just like everybody else. So you kind of got to lift up the veil of a lot of songwriters' songs to really realize what's being said.
Well, let's take, I think, an excellent example of what you're talking about, which is This Is Our Country. And a lot of people know that song from the Chevrolet Silverado ad. And it sounds like, an American anthem when you just hear...
The chorus.
The chorus.
Right.
But I'm going to ask you to sing a verse from it that gives a very different impression than what people might have walked away from the ad. And this is, can you do the verse that goes, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive? And room enough here for science to live?
Well, there's room enough here. Let me see if I can do it. Well, there's room enough here for science. I got a cigarette in my mouth. I take it.
No, take it out.
Hold on. All right, here we go. Well, there's room enough here for science to live. And there's room enough here for religion to forgive. And try to understand all the people of this land. This is our country. Yeah, I think that, simply because it was my one and only television commercial, that outraged a lot of people, and what the song is really about was missed. But, I knew that was going to happen. But I really had no... idea how much that song was going to be played.
This Is Our Country is kind of like a plea to end the culture wars, to be inclusive, to respect each other.
Yes.
Do you feel it became an anthem for something else in the minds of many people?
Oh, I don't care. I mean, it became an anthem for Chevrolet, I think.
Right.
I mean, because that's how they discovered the song, because they couldn't discover the song in the way that they discovered Pink Houses, or the way that they discovered, you know, I Need a Lover. It's impossible to do, you know, to discover a song that way.
But what went through your mind when Chevrolet asked you to use it? Did you think immediately this would be a good idea? Did you have reservations about it?
Oh, listen, I had spoken out against. I was the same way that you are, and I still don't think that an artist should have to get involved with Wall Street on any level. That's not what I really do. I don't write songs for commercials, but I did this because I thought, well, perhaps they are right. I had so many people saying, John, you have turned down fortunes and fortunes of money. And now is the time. The music business has changed. Nobody is, your songs can't grow from the ground up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So go from it from a different angle. So that's what we did.
And what did you learn from the experience?
I learned that an artist shouldn't have to do this. This is not what my songs are about. But I also learned that Chevrolet was a better record company than Columbia.
Because they got your song out there.
Well, because they also, what they said they were going to do, they did. They kept their word.
Which was?
Well, record companies never keep their word. That's the point of the whole conversation.
Uh-huh, okay.
Record companies say we're going to do this, this, and this, and this, and they never did any of it.
I also want to talk with you about Pink Houses, which is the song that John McCain had briefly used in his campaign. And we'll talk about what happened with that. But play the hook from it so everybody knows the song.
Let's see how that goes. Ain't that America? Okay, here we go. Ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America? Something to see, babe. Ain't that America? Home of the free, yeah. Little pink houses for you and me.
So when you found out John McCain was using it in his campaign, and you are a lifelong Democrat, how did you decide to handle it?
I wouldn't say I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm very liberal.
Okay, right. You can vote whatever you want, but you're very liberal.
I'm very liberal.
Got it.
Yes, very liberal. What happened was is that I called up my publicity guy, a guy named Bob Merlis. I said, Bob said, you know, McCain's using your song. And I said, well, he can use it if he wants to, but you probably ought to write him a letter and say, you know, not only, you know, that you guys are using it, but so is Barack Obama, so is John Edwards, so is Hillary Clinton. And you should understand that Mellencamp is very liberal, and do you really think that it's pushing your agenda in the right direction? I mean, you're just really falling in line with all the other liberal candidates. Maybe you guys should rethink using the song. We didn't tell him not to use it. We just wrote a letter that said, you know, why don't you guys might want to rethink about using this song. And they quit using it.
When you write songs like Pink Houses or This Is Our Country or R.O.C.K. in the USA, do you think I'm going to sit down and write an anthem?
No, not really, because if you hear me play these songs, like you just heard me, they're not anthems at all. They're folk songs.
That's true.
I mean, you know, like I just played the chorus of Pink Houses. That's not an anthem. That's a folk song. But see, that's what I was talking about. And all the songs that you named were music from the 80s that had to be, you know, dressed up in a certain way or they weren't going to be on the radio. If I, like, you know, I'm going to go out on tour and I'm going to play just me and acoustic guitar, and all of these songs take on a whole different feeling or meaning when you hear me playing by myself, because they're not wrapped up in the music of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just songs. I'll give you a good example. Hold on. Listen. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a lover that won't drive me mad. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a girl like one I ain't never had. It's a whole different song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different song than the song that you grew up hearing and you know, I grew up playing. But that's what the music of the time required. But don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of hit records. And, you know, I'm 57 years old. I'm still out playing shows, and people still know my songs. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate about all that. So I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, trying to be an artist inside the music business has always been challenging for me.
John Mellencamp speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with Mellencamp in the second half of the show. His new CD, produced by T-Bone Burnett, is called No Better Than This. You can hear all of the songs from his new CD on our website, freshair.npr.org, where they will be streaming for the next 2 weeks. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
She spends all our money, and then she tells me I'm too tight. She calls me Sonny, cause she thinks that I'm so bright. She likes love in the morning, I like it at night. Gee, it's a clumsy old world. Gee, it's a clumsy old world. She don't eat meat, but she smokes cigarettes. She remembers things that I'm trying to forget. We both can't hold a grudge, but she always forgets. Gee, it's a clump.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, back with more of Terry's interview with John Mellencamp. His new CD, No Better Than This, was recorded while he was on a national tour with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. But it was recorded on his days off, when he would take an old Ampex tape recorder, a single microphone, and record new songs in some very significant old locations, from Sun Studios in Memphis to the First African Baptist Church, a stop on the Underground Railroad, in Savannah, Georgia. Mellencamp grew up in a small town in Indiana. When Terry spoke with him last year, she asked him about the first record he bought when he was a kid.
The first record I ever bought was The Twist. With my own money, I bought that by Chubby Checker, and I was like maybe, you know, 7 or 6 years old. This girl that lived next door to us, her and I entered the Twist contest in the window of the dime store in Seymour, Indiana, and we won the Twist contest. But we didn't really have any Twist music, so I had to go buy Chubby Checker. But I grew up in a household where my dad is only 20 years older than me, so my dad had, you know, I had access to a lot of music, and my dad thought at the time, I think he was, you know, him and his buddy had bongo parties where they bongo. So, you know, I was exposed to Woody Guthrie, Odetta, you know, all kind of music through my father's record collection. So, and I had an older brother who was 4 years older than me who also played guitar and was really a much better singer than me.
Could you maybe play an excerpt of a song that you feel is like in your DNA because you heard it and loved it when you were young? Either a song that you discovered on your own or a song from your father's collection that's just kind of in your blood?
Let me see. Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown. And soon you'll sink like a stone. Anyway, my brother had that, brought that record home in 1963, 1962, whatever year it came out, and it made a huge impression on me, that Bob Dylan fella.
Yeah, what impact did Dylan have on you when you were young?
Well, I mean, he was ultimate songwriter. You know, I never even considered writing songs until I was much older, because I was a singer in a rock band. You know, I was in a bar. You remember, you know, the mid-70s. There were so many rock bars. You know, and I was one of those guys, you know, playing and singing. And there was no reason for me to write a song, because there were so many beautiful songs out. And you know, in one hand, you know, I had Bob Dylan, and in the other hand, I had Iggy Pop, you know, and we would go from a Dylan song to a Stooges song all in one set. So, you know, there was no reason for me to write songs. So, but Bob Dylan was always the ultimate songwriter, and nobody could ever write a song as good as him, and nobody ever has written songs as good as him, and, you know, so, you know, what I thought it...
So what made you think about writing songs, not just singing them?
I got a record deal.
And you had to write because of that?
Yeah.
Really? So you hadn't written songs
before? Oh, you know, I'd written songs, you know, to get girls to come over to the house or something, but other than that, you know, I was never really serious about songwriting until probably 1980 something or another. Let me stop you.
So when you'd write a song to get a girl to come over to the house,
yeah,
would you stare into her eyes in a dreamy way as you played the song?
No, I never had to do that.
No.
I never had to do that. They just dropped everything. You know, girls at that time, if you had a guitar, they liked you. And, you know, I wasn't the only one. I mean, you know, there was a long line of guys walking around my town with the guitar case.
Do you remember any of those early songs? Could I impose on you to play a few bars of one of them?
I don't know if I can even remember any of them. I remember the first song I ever learned on a guitar.
Okay.
I was 9 years old. Railroad Bill, lived way up on Railroad Hill. Ride, ride, ride. Railroad Bill, well, he never worked and he never will. Ride, ride, ride. That's the first song I ever learned on guitar.
I don't think I know that. Whose is that?
Oh, it's just an old folk song. I'm a folk singer, you know, and that's what I always did. You know, I'd always been in bands, but I was always, always had an acoustic guitar and always sang those old American folk songs, you know.
And yet, I read that in one of your bar bands, you did a lot of James Brown covers.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, James Brown was, you know, he was the Bob Dylan of soul. I mean, you know, sure, I was in a band called the Crepe Soul, and that's all we did. It was me and I hate to identify him in this fashion, but a black kid, me and a black kid were lead singers. I was 14, he was 18, and everybody else in the band was 21. Now, can you imagine letting a 14-year-old kid get in a car today with a bunch of 21-year-old guys going to a bar every weekend and playing? But my parents let me do it, and that's how I did. And I, you know, I'd bring home $25, $35 every weekend. They were happy about it.
So you moved from Indiana to New York to get close to the record industry.
That's not true.
No? Okay, go ahead.
No. I moved from Indiana to London.
Oh.
And I lived in London in 1977 and 78. And the only reason I moved to London that I had a record deal when I actually, here's what happened. It's a boring story. It's the same old story you've heard a million times. Anyway, I go to New York, and I wanted to take a look at the New York Art Student League, or I wanted to get a record deal. I didn't really care which. Is it going to be a painter or a songwriter? Since the Art Student League cost a lot of money, that was out because I had no money. And I went there, and it wasn't this simple, but I got a record deal pretty rapidly. And then it was, I made a couple records that were terrible. I was managed by the same guy that managed Bowie. And he tried to recreate me into an American David Bowie. It just didn't work, and him and I fought all the time. And that's where Johnny Cougar came from. And all
was that his idea?
Yeah, it was a terrible idea. I told him at the time it was a terrible idea. And, of course, he didn't like that. You know, he wasn't going to take that from snappy young brats such as myself. You know, he was the P.T. Barnum of the whole thing. He created David Bowie and reminded me of that all the time. But anyway, so I was with him I made a couple records with him that were terrible, terrible, not worth listening, not worth looking at. And then I met a manager who was a shyster, and he said, you know, I can't get a record deal here in the United States for you, but if you come to London, I can get one in Europe. So we moved to London, and I lived in London for 2 years. And it was a great experience, and eye-opening for, you know, to move from Seymour, Indiana to London, England, and be living on right in Chelsea, and the whole punk rock thing was just starting to explode, and there I was with an acoustic guitar.
Right. Let me ask you about one of your early hits, and this is Jack and Diane from 1982. Well, there's a great line in that, life goes on even after the thrill of living is gone.
See, there you go. Now we're talking about mortality again.
Yes, exactly. I know that occurred to me. That definitely occurred to me. Can you talk about how that line came to you?
Well, actually, they're putting together a box set of my songs, and the guy was just here yesterday who's producing it, was working on it, and this guy's leaving no stone unturned. So he found a song that I had written before Jack and Diane called Jenny at 16 that had some of the same lines from Jack and Diane in it that I had abandoned that song, Jenny at 16, and turned it into Jack and Diane. And in the original writing of Jack and Diane, he discovered that Jack was black. So even back then, I was talking about interracial things, but for some reason or another, had abandoned that idea. So Jack and Diane was originally about an interracial couple, but I guess in 1981, I think maybe I decided maybe this is a little too pushing it too far, because, you know, this country is a pretty racist place, and so particularly in 81.
Can you do a few bars of Jack and Diane?
Yeah. Hold on. A little ditty about Jack and Diane, two man kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star, Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on a chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between his knees. Jackie said, hey, Diane, let's run off behind the shade of trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, girl, let me do what I please. Oh, yeah, life goes on. Long after the thrill of living is gone. Oh, yeah, say life goes on. Long after the thrill of living is gone. They walk on. That's it.
Did you know when you were writing that it would be really good to put in, like, details in the song, like the Tasty Freeze or the Chili Dogs? I mean, like, story writers think of details like that. Songwriters don't always.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I can say this very crudely to you. A lot of those songs back then were not really written in my mind. They were written, you know, below my belt. They were songs that were only emotional. There was no, I wasn't sophisticated enough to think, oh, I should put a detail in here. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a guy in a band in a bar. And, you know, I saw what people did and partook in what people did in those bars. I was part of that scene in the Midwest. And it was a, you know, it was a rough-ass crowd some nights, and some nights it wasn't, you know. So that's where songs like Lonely All Night came from. Music was a sideline for me at that time. You know, all my songs are written below my belt. And then as I got older, they kind of raised up to my head and became more of, you know, you should pay attention to what you're writing because people are actually listening.
I wanted to ask you something, and this gets back to what we were talking about early on about mortality. And this question might strike you as kind of odd and a real stretch, and maybe it is, but I know that you were born with a tumor on your spine.
I was born with spina bifida.
That's like an opening in your spine, isn't it?
Yes, that's what it is.
That's really dangerous.
Well, in 1951, it was deadly. In 1951, you know, they would operate on people with, you know, with pinking shears and screwdrivers. And, and you know, they were still giving people lobotomies in 1951. You know, so the medical world was pretty not developed, not like today. And I was born with spina bifida, and it used to be the practice to let the baby lay there for 2 or 3 weeks, and if the baby survived, then they would operate on the baby. Thank God for me that there was a young doctor named Dr. Heinberger at Riley's Children's Hospital in Indianapolis who said, we've got to stop this letting these kids die and letting them lay there because they won't survive. So the minute we see it, let's operate on them. And that's what he did with me. And generally, if you are born with that disease, wherever they operate on you from, you're crippled from that point down. My hole in my spine was right below my ears. So I should have been crippled from the neck down.
Do you think, and this is the part that's like really the stretch, because you were born so vulnerable and that you had a condition that nearly killed you, that could have killed you, do you think that you have some like retention of that and that there's something like deep inside that has always been in touch with mortality and vulnerability because of that? I mean, and even if you weren't aware of it, like your parents would have been.
Well, my parents didn't even tell me until I was, until some kid at school said to me when I was about in fifth or sixth grade, I'm sure. I was sitting in class and some kid goes, "Man, what's that big scar across the back of your neck?" And I said, "What scar?" I didn't know there was a scar on the back of my neck. Apparently my parents told my brothers not to say anything to me, and they never said anything to me. And so I remember going home and going, "What's the scar on my neck?" And then I got the whole nine yards. And at, 9 or 10 years old, I didn't much care. No, at that time I didn't care because I figured, well, I've been a normal kid thus far. I have no reason to believe that I won't be anything but a normal kid. And I played football and I ran track and played baseball and, I did everything everybody else did. But, I don't see that scar on the back of my neck, but, I've been married to Elaine for 17 years, and she said the first time she kissed me and she put her hand on the back of my neck, she thought, "What the world is that?"
Can I close by asking you to do a song that you did not write, that you really love, that's by somebody else?
Okay, I will play a song that I have played at every party.
Oh, great. Okay.
This is my party song, when they hand me a guitar and say, "John, play something." Everybody's laughing at the Early Bird Cafe. I've been hidden there since yesterday, and I believe I've lost my way. Charlotte's there in Albany, and Billy's there in Suede. There's money in their pockets, all the dues are paid. And there's wine on every table, and there's food on every plate. Well, I hope I get there pretty soon, before it gets too late. Well, I ran on down the road a while to the other side of town. My clothes were getting wrinkled, and my socks were falling down. But I could not stop to pull them up, in fear that I'd be late. So I kept on running down the road until I saw the gate of the Early Bird Cafe glowing golden like the sun. Everybody kept on singing, "Can come on," and we just begun. Well, I ran right in and I sat right down and I ordered up some wine. My talk was fast and clever, and the women all were fine. Charlotte asked me where I'd been with jade and ivory eyes, and I told her I'd been hung up with some beggar in disguise. Well, she laughed like temple bells. She kissed me on the cheek and said, "You know, it's hard to be alive sometimes, but it's easy to be dead."
You know, I feel like I should know that song, and I don't. Tell me something about the song.
It's an old folk song, and it was originally recorded by, might even been written by a band called Jerry Hahn Brotherhood, which was a band that I saw play probably in 1968, opening up for Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And they played that song, and I went, "Wow!" But that's my party song. I've been playing that song since I was 17 years old.
To really cheer up the party.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful song.
It is. It is. It's been great to talk with you. I really appreciate your doing this, and thank you for playing for us. I think it was just really generous of you. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure.
John Mellencamp speaking and singing to Terry Gross last year. His new CD, recorded in various spots around the country on his days off while touring with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson, is called No Better Than This. You can hear the entire CD, every track, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where it will be streaming for the next 2 weeks. Marty Stewart has been playing country music professionally since his early teens. From the mid-1980s to the early 90s, Stewart had a lot of mainstream country music success. But as the country industry moved toward more of a pop sound, Stewart became more interested in old-fashioned country music, mostly from the 50s and 60s. His new album, Ghost Train, the Studio B Sessions, features new songs he's written in this throwback style, as well as covers of old hits by other performers. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
A ball and chain, 'cause everywhere I travel see my picture with a number by my name. Spent some time in San Francisco.
Like countless performers before him, Marty Stewart likes to portray himself as hunted, haunted, misunderstood, a rebel on the lam. It's a familiar story, whether it's coming from the blues, honky-tonk, or hip-hop. The trick is to make that story sound fresh. Stewart does that in the ringing guitars and his high lonesome holler on that song called Branded. Whether he intends it or not, Branded is also something of a pun. This new collection is Stewart's proclamation that while he can't help but become a consumer brand, his branding is that of the outsider. All of this would be hopelessly hokey if the music didn't bolster his line of patter.
Our home is like a prison where we're both serving time. I'm a stranger in your world now, and it's driving me out of my mind. Drifting apart, darling, we're drifting apart. Out of reach, out of heart, we're slowly drifting apart.
That's Marty Stewart howling about a broken marriage in what amounts to an homage to the kind of steel guitar super hits George Jones and Buck Owens made decades ago. Stewart wrote the song and produced it himself. The steel guitar is played by Ralph Mooney, the man sometimes credited with inventing the so-called Bakersfield sound on hits with Buck Owens and Wynn Stewart, among many others. Stewart is a fluid guitar player himself who played bluegrass mandolin behind Lester Flatt when Stewart was 13 years old. But he never gets bogged down in fussy arrangements or mere nostalgia. Listen to the way he summons up a whole history of male-female duet singing in a vibrant new song called I Run to You.
I run to you when I'm lonely. I run to you when I'm feeling. Step I take leads to you only. When I need love, I run to you.
Marty Stewart's duet partner there is his wife, Connie Smith, a great country singer, starting with her indelible 1964 hit, Once a Day. Sometimes it seems as though Marty Stewart has built a life that allows him to live in a perpetual country music time machine. He curates exhibits of music memorabilia and photography, and does restoration work on legends such as Porter Wagoner, for whom Stewart produced a lively 2007 album shortly before Wagoner's death at age 80. Stewart has a song on Ghost Train called Porter Wagoner's Grave that's at once eloquent and maudlin in a long tradition of country death songs. All is not gloom and grave dust, however, as Little Heartbreaker demonstrates.
You ain't nothing but a little heartbreaker, a tiny little teardrop mover and a shaker. I swear by the moon and stars above you. You got me wrapped around your pretty little finger. My heart is a bell, you know how to ring her. Said all of this to say, baby, I love you.
The longer you ride in Marty Stewart's Ghost Train, the more its speed and energy hits you like the wind in your face. In the liner notes to his new album, Marty Stewart says that he felt it was time to, quote, write some songs and play some hard-hitting country music. Most of the time, Ghost Train hits hard, dead center, in the sweet spot between old and new, until you can't tell the difference.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Marty Stewart's new album called Ghost Train, the Studio B Sessions. You can listen to three tracks from Marty Stewart's new album on nprmusic.org.
Gonna call old moon, get a little unwound. Go to Mississippi, then a Texas town. Play a little country music along the way. Gotta get away from you, cause you break my mind. Baby, I'm gone for good this time. And adios is all there is to say. You ain't nothing but a little heartbreaker, a tiny little teardrop mover and a shaker. I swear by the moon and stars above you. You got me wrapped around your pretty little finger. My heart is a bell, you know how to ring her. Said all of this to say, baby, I love you.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.